Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do we cultivate, process, and eat the foods we do, and what clues do contemporary cuisines offer to our history? As a historian, my guest today is fascinated by the relationship between what we eat and how we think about our bodies, our souls, our communities and governments, and about the natural world. Rachel Loudon's new book traces important shifts in all those things over time and explores the relationship between changes in our diets and the evolution of human culture. The book is called Cuisine and Empire, Cooking in World History. Rachel Loudon is a visiting scholar at UT, and she joins us today from the studios of KUT in Austin. Rachel, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here, Chris.
What does it take to trace the evolution of food and cooking back well before the beginnings of recorded history?
What does it take? My goodness, that I do leave largely to archaeologists. My story really begins once you get cities and states and the recorded written record. But there's absolutely amazing work going on among archaeologists. They've developed lots of new methods for going back beyond that, and it's going to be a very exciting few years.
So culinary philosophy is a major theme throughout this book. Can you help us understand the term and why it reveals so much about the broader societies from which different dishes and food processing technologies emerged?
I find one way to understand this is to sort of jump out of one's own culture. I remember hearing a very distinguished Indian cookbook author, entrepreneur, chef talk a few years ago. And she said, look, you have to understand, if you're going to cook Indian food, something about the Hindu housewife and what she thinks. And when she goes into the kitchen, of course, she takes into account the things that we do, the cost of food, the time of the year, the colors, whether it will look nice when served. But she also has to think about what point in the Hindu year it is, and whether the foods are heating and cooling in the, not in the sense of hot and cold, but in their effects on their body. And I thought, you know, that's just what we all think. Often we internalize this because we can't make it explicit for every meal. But we do, when we sit down to plan a meal, think about what is healthy, about whether any of our guests have religious preferences, about whether we want to show a certain kind of status or pride in what we're doing. And all these considerations add up to what I call the culinary philosophy of a particular culture.
It's interesting when you talk about status, because I think we might jump to the conclusion that everybody wants to serve the most sort of elaborate food possible when serving guests, that sort of thing. But there have been moments in history where people have very deliberately chosen to reject the food eaten by elites.
Exactly. And America's just a fascinating case of this. We're coming up to Thanksgiving, and there was a huge debate going on in America in the 19th century. In fact, it had gone on from the colonial period, about whether as a new country, a new republic, America should accept the aristocratic dining that was exemplified by French cuisine, or whether as a republic it should reject French cuisine because it was associated with aristocracies and monarchies. And you see that played out in the development of Thanksgiving. When Lincoln declares it a national meal, many people, including those who had agitated for it, specifically say, this must be a meal that the housewife can cook. This must be a simple Republican with a small r, not the current Republican right. Party, but Republican as opposed to aristocratic, meal that the whole family participates in.
So cultures that have relied on grains have historically gained the upper hand over time when up against others that had sort of alternative staple foods. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of grains and why the ability to store grain offers such great power to societies?
Yes, I mean, grains are incredibly concentrated. They're the food for the next generation, and it's packed in this little hard, dry package that includes an incredible range of nutrients for its weight, so that you can just about ship grains into cities and store them. The main alternative for a staple are roots, potatoes, yams, cassava, and those are much heavier and much wetter. That means they cost a great deal more to ship, and they go bad much more quickly. And societies that depended on those just simply didn't have the resources necessary to set up large cities.
Hmm. Well, you talk about barley wheat cuisine and the role that it played in the spread of early Eurasian empires.
Yes, it's really striking that when you begin to get the first empires around 3000 BC and up through really until the arrival of rice's arrival, every early empire depends on barley and wheat. Out of all the possible things in the world, humans have winnowed down the choices of the basic food to just two. It's quite extraordinary, but it is because of these tremendous advantages that they have.
And so those foods and then also the ideas related to them, ultimately as culture spread, those ideas would spread along with the foods in conquered territories?
The ideas that shaped them, yes, they do. The idea, for example, that the rich eat very differently from the poor, that the rich eat the fine processed and distant food, spreads with these empires. If we go a little bit later to one that everybody will probably be familiar with, when you get the spread of Christianity across Europe and then across the Americas, with it goes bread and wine and the foods that Christians value.
You know, it's interesting, too, when we talk about food and culture and religion, because there is the idea, depending on the beliefs that you subscribe to, that food is either something that is required by the tenets of your religion. Sometimes there are certain foods that are proscribed by religion, and sometimes mm-hmm. religion requires food to be sacrificed.
Ah, yes. I mean, with one of the big and interesting transitions in food history occurs around the birth of Christ. It wasn't till I was writing this book that I realized just how important sacrifice was in early human history, or early state history, put it that way. All the early states, Rome, Greece, the Persian Empire, the Indian empires, the Chinese empires, the most important meal is the feast that follows the sacrifice. And it has a kind of logic, because the idea is that the gods provided these wonderful grains and other foods for humans. And humans, in turn, must feed the gods. So the humans offer grain, they offer domesticated animals, the smoke goes up on the sacrificial fires and feeds the gods. And then, I mean, very nicely, the leftovers, which is the cooked meat, goes to feed the population in a great sacrificial feast. And this is the equivalent of today's Thanksgiving.
You started thinking about all of this during a time that you were living in Hawaii. Will you talk to us about how history there was sort of a great microcosm by which to study these ideas and really develop your thinking about all this?
Yes, it was an extraordinary experience. I went to Hawaii thinking, you know, that it was just sun, sand, and beaches. And I discovered that it was one of the most complex societies I'd ever lived in, because not only were there the Pacific Island people, the indigenous Hawaiians, who were about a third of the population, but there were also what we might call the Anglos, the English and the Americans, who had gone to live in the islands, many to run plantations, another third of the population. And then there were the people who had been brought in to work the plantations from China, from Japan, from Okinawa, from Korea, from Southeast Asia. And these three groups were just, as you say, a little microcosm. The Asians were mainly Buddhists, and they favored rice, and they cooked in wok. The Hawaiians had an animist religion, sometimes with Christian overlays. They cooked in underground ovens and they ate taro. And the Anglos ate bread and beef and used modern stoves and modern medicine, modern dietary theory. So you have these three just radically different families of cuisine jammed up against each other in these tiny islands in the middle of the Pacific.
So there must be unusual combinations of foods or things that people maybe on an everyday basis now don't think much about that reflect all three of those things coming together.
Oh, absolutely. And probably the kind of classic one is the plate lunch, which everybody eats in Hawaii. And the main staple is rice. That comes from the Asian tradition. It has a huge pile of meat with gravy. That comes from the Anglo tradition. And often it will be served with Hawaiian additions, Hawaiian seaweed as a relish, Hawaiian curry as a main dish. So this meal puts together the whole of the Hawaiian experience.
Will you go back and talk a little bit more about what I think is called, is it humor theory? And you spoke about, an Indian housewife might think about the way that certain foods affect the body. This is something, a kind of thinking that a number of different cultures have subscribed to over the course of history.
Absolutely. In fact, I think it was the commonest way of thinking about food until the 17th century, and many cultures still think about that food that way. And that is that certain foods, meat, alcohol, are things that will make the body and the temperament and the character hotter. So you would think about being inflamed by blood and alcohol, whereas others are cooling. We still stay cool as a cucumber. And so vegetables and fruits tend to be things that calm you down, that cool you down. And in the middle are things like wheat and rice, bread and rice and chicken, which are just perfectly suited to the normal human state.
So you're making choices not when food choices were available. People were choosing not only based on what the foods would taste like. In fact, that was important but secondary. Is that right?
It's very parallel to now, because we will choose what foods we want based on how they taste, but we will also at the same time have in the back of our mind that we really ought to have some protein and we ought to have something that has vitamins. And so the same would have happened in the past. People would have said to themselves, well, you know, I'm feeling a bit tense and angry today, so I should have something that's going to calm me down. I should have extra vegetables, but I'd like them to taste nice too.
My guest is historian and author Rachel Loudon. Her new book is called Cuisine and Empire, Cooking in World History. If you've got a question or maybe you want to share some of your experiences when traveling or your studies of history, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian and author Rachel Loudon. Her new book is called Cuisine and Empire, Cooking in World History. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You can also send a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Rachel, a trade has certainly been had a great impact on the ways that we eat and the kinds of foods and cooking techniques we've been introduced to. Can you speak a little bit about some of the most interesting trade routes that you've covered in your studies?
Oh, my goodness. Yes. I mean, another of the great surprises to me was that food was, if not global, at least all across Eurasia or all across the Americas from very early on. What we call the Silk Roads that joined the Mediterranean with China, with branches down to Persia and India. Wheat had traveled along those by 3000 BC at least from the Mediterranean to China. There's another huge set of trade routes that link coastal China with Southeast Asia and round to India. And those two are, I guess, the major ways that food spreads up until Columbus. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the Atlantic and the Pacific come in. The Atlantic's well known, the trade in corn and sugar and tobacco and all those kinds of commodities across the Atlantic, obviously. But again, another surprise was how early and important the Pacific was, and how from 1550 on, 1560, Mexicans are, for example, importing Filipinos to work coconut plantations to provide alcoholic drinks for workers in the mines in Mexico.
And alcohol was very often used because sources of water were not necessarily trustworthy.
Historians debate that, but certainly alcohol was widely used instead of water. It also had other benefits, of course, besides being safer. It was a mild analgesic when a lot of labor was incredibly heavy and painful. And it, you know, also made the day a bit nicer.
So when we sort of pat ourselves on the back for eating fusion food because we've had Korean tacos for lunch or something, we feel very, very modern. But it sounds like food has been fusion food for a very, very long time.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there is no non-fusion food. And some of these distant links are really quite extraordinary. We think of the Mongols, for example, as, you know, sort of the antithesis of cuisine, people galloping about on horses and, you know, drinking blood from their necks. But when they set up their empire in China, they bring in the best Persian and Indian cooks. This is in 1250 AD, and make a wonderful fusion cuisine that reflects the entire Mongol Empire from Russia round the rim of Eurasia to China. And today we still see the remains of that because everywhere that you get little meat dumplings, that's where the Mongol Empire was.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Bert in Dallas. Hello, Bert.
Hi. You know, in the past, when we were hunter-gatherers, my understanding is we were we had healthy teeth and bones. And we were much bigger than immediately after we started to become farmers and relying on grain. We shrunk in stature with you know, poor health outcomes for the long run, for a long time. Of course, now the pendulum has swung and we eat too much meat. And so my first question is, well, can you comment on that historical trend? And now, you see people like Clinton, recently Al Gore, going vegan. Do you see that as a trend that would be good for the health and the planet? So can you comment on that?
There's a lot of ground there to cover. First, on the Paleolithic diet, which is very fashionable at the moment, two things. First, I think the verdict is still to some extent out on whether or not the Paleolithic diet was as wonderfully healthy as we think. It's really very difficult to separate out the nutritional benefits from the lifestyle in general. And certainly there's no hope of going back to it. We wouldn't like it. We can't reproduce it. We have bred plants and animals to be very different. And what is called a Paleolithic diet today is a very different thing from what would have been eaten 30, 40,000 years ago. On whether you're going to go vegan, well, it's a million-dollar question that agricultural experts are talking about, whether we can produce enough raw materials to feed the world. And certainly vegetables or plant raw materials are favored by many. Against that, I rather doubt that that is going to work. Partly because there are many areas where you can grow, raise animals, but not plants. And secondly, because we'd have to have a tremendous change in human character. Meat has been the most desired food for almost everybody in the human race for almost ever. Maybe we could make that change across the whole human race. Maybe we'll have to, but it wouldn't be easy.
Is it a relatively recent thing in our history, Rachel, that small subsets of the population even have the ability to choose what they're eating rather than sort of, as a matter of course, having on their tables what all of their neighbors have on their tables?
Yes. For most people, through most of history, it was eat it or leave it. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have any choice. And we're in this very interesting situation today. And I actually think it's, you know, rather a rewarding one. People are able to design their own diets. That's both a tremendous responsibility because, you know, you can't just say, well, I had to eat this because it was all that was there. It's a tremendous opportunity, but it also means that there's tremendous anxiety around food just because there is that choice.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Spencer calling from Arlington. Hi, Spencer. Hello, Spencer. Are you with us?
It's Hunter.
Hunter. Sorry. Hi, Hunter.
That's all right. I was wondering, more talking about the sacrifice in that role, there was a great, obviously, shift away from sacrifice of animals. Was that more of a theological change, or was that a economic change, or some sort of combination of both?
I mean, we don't have direct access to this. I think it was largely a theological change. A large number of thinkers emerge, beginning around 2000 BC, saying that the sacrificial bargain, you know, God gives us food and we feed the gods, is not the way to true spirituality. And the Buddhists are the first to make this shift, and then it follows in all kinds of world religions. And by, say, 800 BC, most of the world's population, not all of it, but most of the world's population, has largely abandoned sacrifice in terms of the religions that we talk about today.
That's interesting. So we began to look at the morality of our own behavior rather than any sort of, one-for-one deal that we could strike with our deities.
I think, yes. I mean, it wasn't an easy transition because this sacrificial bargain is a very understandable way of dealing with unseen forces, of what you believe may be out there. And I think all of us are still susceptible to it today. If we're in real trouble, we're perhaps apt to say, well, you know, if I get through this, then I promise I will do something, you know, for the rest of my life. I will, you know, go to church every week or whatever it happens to be. But no, it does go towards an idea of individual enlightenment, and the foods change as a result, because what particularly the leaders of these religions want are foods that will enable them to lead a spiritual life. So the Buddhists, for example, abandon meat and alcohol in favor of a largely vegetarian diet, calming rice, butter and sugar, which are rich but not inflaming like meat and alcohol.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Robbie in Plano. Hi, Robbie.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, I think my question may have been answered. My question was, why does a particular religion or a leader feel the need to ban a certain food? Why should there be a ban to eating pork among the Jewish people? I know it could be just religious philosophy, but is it because it was unhealthy, people were falling sick? Similarly, I'm perplexed why there should be a vast majority of Indians should be vegetarian. Even people that live in the coastal areas, they are mostly vegetarian, even though there might be abundance of fish. This is the only major cuisine in the world that is largely predominantly vegetarian, which as a result, the vegetarian Indian dishes are very tasty because they have developed over the years. But is it just cultural, or there's something more attributed to why a certain shift happens in a culture toward a certain cuisine?
Well, thanks for your call.
Yeah, really important questions. There was an argument for some years that pork was abandoned because it could be dangerous to eat, particularly in hot climates. I think that's now been abandoned. Pork is very closely associated with the Western Mediterranean, where Christianity gets going or gets established. And there, pork is used as a way of distinguishing Christians and Jews from very early on. In India, yes, India is quite fascinating. It's the first big, when we're talking about the shift in India towards a vegetarian diet, which takes hundreds of years to bring about, India is the richest and most sophisticated country in the world. We're talking now 500 BC to 500 AD. And so it's not economic necessity or anything like that, but the three great religions there, Hinduism, Jainism, and Buddhism, all move towards diets that they see as more conducive to enlightenment, because in this humoral scheme of things, they encourage tranquility and contemplation rather than military exploits and action, which was associated with meat and alcohol.
Is there any particular pattern by which different societies sort of settled on flatbreads or leavened breads?
Basically, leavened breads are in the Christian world. Whether that has to some extent, I think, something to do with the idea that force that causes breads to rise is, it has something, it is spirit, and that is linked to the idea of God. Flatbreads are almost entirely in the Islamic world. And symbolic of that, but why, I mean, wheat is regarded in both Christianity and Islam as the healthiest of grains. And then, of course, once you've got that decision, you want to distinguish the two groups. So you differentiate by having different forms of bread.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Arthur on the line now in Keene. Hello, Arthur.
Yes, hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I didn't hear the very beginning of the program, but when I turned it on, you were talking about the humors and, you know, heating foods and cooling foods.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I lived for several years in China where that's very strong tradition in the Chinese cuisine, you know, from everywhere. And I wondered about the connection between the two. Like, if Europeans had this tradition as well, did they perchance get it from the Chinese or vice versa?
Thanks for your call.
I think the general reckoning is it's a big question. Does this theory, which is everywhere in the early period, is it the result of just the way people think, or is it the result of interactions between different cultures? Certainly in Western Eurasia, from India through the Mediterranean, it's all interlinked. People are going backwards and forwards. Physicians, missionaries, merchants, and they're carrying these ideas with them. And I think that also happens with China. Certainly when Buddhism goes to China, the Chinese send people back to India, and they return to China with the Buddhist medical texts, which are very explicit on the humoral system, and they translate these into Chinese. This is about 200 AD.
My guest is historian and author Rachel Loudon. Her new book is called Cuisine and Empire, Cooking in World History. You can be part of the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with historian Rachel Loudon, author of the new book Cuisine and Empire, Cooking in World History. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Rachel, to the extent that early Christian cuisines combined, I guess, Jewish food traditions and some Roman traditions, what did that look like?
Well, obviously, the Jewish traditions come in meals like the Last Supper, the idea that there is a sacred meal that everybody will sit down and enjoy. But at the time, Judaism was part of the Roman Empire, and so the overarching kind of diet of bread and wine was common to both Jews and Romans. What they specifically take from the Romans, I think the early Christians, is the idea that this should be a simple and frugal cuisine. It goes back to what we were talking about, Thanksgiving. This is one of those moments where people turn away from very elaborate cuisines, and Christianity as a religion that is advertising itself or promoting itself as open to everybody insists, like certain Romans, that the most important way to organize a cuisine is to have one that everybody can enjoy.
We have an email here from Phil who asks, any thoughts as to why only Catholics do not consider fish to be meat? And I guess he's referring to the fact that during Lent and other times when Catholics are fasting, they don't eat land animals, but they do. They are permitted to eat fish.
Yes, this is an interesting question because there was a huge long debate that went on throughout Christianity about what animals and what other substances did and did not break the Christian fast. Christianity is very unusual in the cuisine. Christian cuisine is unusual in world cuisines in for most of its history, suggesting that people refrain from animal products for substantial parts of the year. For most of its history, this was 50% of the year. Of course, that's vanished nowadays, except for a very few occasions. But then the question was, what should be in and what should be out? Sugar be in? Should sugar be out? Should fish be in? Should fish be out? There is not one single answer to this. Every case is fought out on the nature of the food, often in terms of the humoral theory.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Matthew on the line next in Fort Worth. Hello, Matthew.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, I was wondering if you had heard of the fasting diet. I heard about it on NPR, and I was wondering what your thoughts were about it and if you think that it's medically supported.
This is the diet where you just fast one day and then eat normally another day or a certain proportion.
I believe it's 2 days.
Yeah. As a historian, I'm not a nutritionist and I don't think I'm in a position to comment on that, though it's an interesting idea.
Fast, though, throughout history and in a lot of different cultures have been part of, I suppose, mostly religious tradition. Have there been traditions of sort of secular fasting as well?
I think, yes, there are traditions. Often in societies where food is not that readily available all year round, in deserts or on the plains among Indians, for example, where fasting is also regarded as a training, a necessary thing to learn to endure, because if you cannot withstand lack of food for periods of time, you're going to have a hard time surviving.
Hmm. How have different cultures interpreted the right way to eat, not necessarily the right foods to eat, but the times of days that people eat and whether it's appropriate or not to eat between meals and where you should sit or stand or consume your food?
Oh, my goodness. This is all kinds of things. I mean, just two examples. Let's start with the family meal, because it's so familiar to everybody, and then go to a stranger one. The family meal we think of as completely normal, that everybody sits down around the table. But really, that's a very recent invention in the United States within the last 100 years. And before that, of course, women would cook the food, but people would eat it out of a common bowl when and, you know, wherever they could. And the idea that you have a table laid and everybody comes and it's a specific moment is very recent. The other, much more distant one, but that is who can eat with a king? Mm. If one of the things that food is supposed to do is to show your status, and the king is the most important person of all. Many societies say the king has to eat by himself, or maybe just with his wife or one or two associates. But he sits on a platform and everybody else looks at him eating because they could not dare to share a meal with him.
Wow. Is there, is it possible to name the most dominant global food culture today, or is it, are we so intertwined that we can't really figure this out?
I think today it would be the American food culture. The dominant food culture always tends to follow the dominant political power. People make an association, knowingly or not. They tend to assume that if an empire or a nation is really powerful, that one reason is that the people in it are eating something that makes them powerful. And I think one reason for the rapid spread of hamburgers around the world is not that everybody loves hamburgers. Lots of people don't. But to eat a hamburger is to participate in a little way in the strength and power of the United States. You may reject that strength and power, but you just want to know what it's like.
And this has happened in other times in history, so that if there was a the Greeks were on top of things, the Romans would come along and try to eat like the Greeks.
Yes, and if Islam, if Persia was on top of things, people would try to eat like the Persians. So this is a recurrent pattern. There's a kind of counter pattern once you get. Particularly once you begin to get nations that people want to distinguish themselves from other people. So that means they try to eat something that's different. But so you've got these two forces sort of in tension, one trying to eat like the most powerful nations or empires around, but on the other hand, trying to distinguish yourself from them and show your own identity.
Rachel, what can we think about the next time we go to a restaurant that serves anything, you know, American cuisine or some foreign cuisine to this country? What can we pay attention to that might help us understand the culture from which that food comes a little better?
I think, I mean, asking yourself the question, why is this regarded as good to eat in that cuisine? Because we always do think before we eat, and that shapes what we eat. So why is it that when we go out and have a Chinese meal, that there will be meat and vegetables in the same dish, and then we might remember the humoral theory and the fact that the cooling vegetables are balancing the heating meat. And that will be a way into understanding something about Chinese culture.
Can you talk a little bit about the technologies we've used to prepare our food and how we've shared those along the way? It's not simply just ingredients. It's also, I guess, approaches to getting them ready.
Absolutely. I mean, we often talk about plants and animals as food, and that's a terrible mistake, I think. I mean, because we don't eat plants and we don't eat animals. We only eat them after we have done things to them. If you think about clothes, you know, we don't wear lamb sort of sheep fleeces and cotton balls. We only wear them once they've been spun and woven and made into dresses. So food is something that we have made from raw materials, the raw materials being these plants and animals. And my goodness, we do everything you can imagine to them. We beat them mechanically, grind, pound, churn, press. We put chemicals on them. We marinate them. We leach alkalis out of them. We heat them, obviously, and cool them and evaporate them. And we let little microbes go to work for us, microorganisms, when we ferment them. So the history of food, to me, is incredibly tightly tied up with the history of these techniques we use to turn raw materials into something that is good to eat, that is good to think and good to eat.
So even today, we have sort of conflicted feelings about food and about, you know, food as a symbol of our virtue or our vice. But we do, at least in the United States today, live in a country where, you know, absolute starvation levels of food deprivation are quite rare. Do you think that, I mean, when we look at all the processed foods that have sort of, many people feel, corrupted our diets, how do you think our ancestors would have felt if the trade-off they'd had to make hundreds of years ago was that they wouldn't have to go hungry, but they might be eating a lot of, you know, what most people agreed was sort of junk food?
They'd have thought they were in heaven, I think. Yes, I mean, I think the question, I mean, all food is processed. I mean, so the question is not, for the reasons I've just mentioned, so the question is not whether or not we should give up processed food, but which foods do we want to keep of the processed foods? And that means which ones are the good ones. And that's what makes the problem really difficult, because what's good for think for me, you know, I may want the cheapest food if I'm very poor, which is not going to be what somebody rich who wants the tastiest food is going to want, though we might be able to agree on safety. So it gets very difficult to decide which of these foods, and I don't like the term junk food if I can avoid it, because at least it gives calories, which has been the major thing we've needed through most of human history. But it's very difficult to decide which foods, and I tend to be very liberal about people choosing what they want.
Are you a fan of Thanksgiving? It's come up a few times in this conversation, and if so, would you share with us sort of what your Thanksgiving table looks like if you prepare one?
I am a fan of Thanksgiving just because it is a perfect example of a meal that is accessible to everybody, and for most of history, you know, the rich had high cuisines, 10% of the people, and 90% of people ate porridge or something like porridge. So the fact that in America everybody can sit down to a meal that is basically affordable by everybody, I think is wonderful. My Thanksgiving table this year is going to be the turkey and the dressing, and it will have a Spanish-Mexican tinge to it, because we're inviting friends who come, who are visiting Austin from Mexico and from Spain.
Very nice.
And they're bringing, yeah.
The new book by historian and author Rachel Loudon, who is a visiting scholar at the University of Texas currently, is called Cuisine and Empire, Cooking in World History. She joined us from the studios of KUT in Austin. Rachel, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Christine McConnell prepares our podcast, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.